questions?
So I don't know, I have questions. I think I only have two zombie problems turned in. I don't know if that's de rigueur or whether I should expect more zombies. So we did a fair amount, and I kind of recommend going online and taking a look at the notes for that class and following the audio. I did an audio without you present, so it was a lot shorter, but it goes over some of these same sorts of things. In some sense, we didn't do a whole lot, right? So the main event was this statement here, that if we're in a spatially anti-symmetric state, and let me comment that very frequently, but not always, we can separate out the spin part and the space part, and we can talk about being symmetrical under just spatial coordinate exchange or just spin coordinate exchange. Spin statistics deals with exchanging both of those at the same time, but often we can just talk about one or the other. So if you are odd under space exchange, and what that means is that if you switch the coordinates of 1 and 2, the wave function switches sign, then that means that the particles are further apart. And if it's even under exchange, then it means that they're closer together. And this is, you know, kind of a qualitative statement, so we didn't kind of have a perfect proof of it. The book goes through an example in one dimension. What we did in class is use Mathematica to look at the two particles in a square well problem. And both came to the same conclusion, that the separation between the two particles, x1 minus x2 squared, was small if it was even, and it was big if it was odd. So the kind of pedagogical problem we have is that if we have a Hamiltonian where we have no interactions, where the Hamiltonian is just a sum of simple terms, then you know the wave function can be just written as a product of simple terms, and the whole thing is pretty dull. That is to say that in the end, the energy of this multi-particle system is just the sum of the energies of each particle separately. And all of this big deal about fermion boson doesn't seem to play a big role as part of energy is concerned. But as I told you, the spin statistics theorem is super important. It's, you know, maybe the single most true thing that's in our book. So it's kind of hard, except by pounding you over the head, to say that it's important, given what we've got. So kind of the approach we said, which will be justified in the next chapter, is we really can't solve these problems if they're interactions. We can't solve the differential equations, at least not without the help of a computer. Can't do it on the blackboard. But if we just shove the interaction potential between the two wave functions and do the integral, that allows us to judge how the eigenenergies are going to change. So in the case of the hydrogen atom, the force between the nucleus and the electron, that's shared among all of the electrons. That's part of one of the H1, H2 sort of stuff. On the other hand, the repulsive electric force between multiple electrons, that isn't a separate Hamiltonian. That's an interaction piece, and that's the source of the problem. We're never going to solve that problem on a blackboard sort of thing. So there, the approach we took was to deal with the helium atom, which has two electrons. In the ground state, things are simple. Both of the electrons have to be in the lowest energy state. That's symmetric, so we have to use an anti-symmetric spin state, so we put them in singlets. One spin up, one spin down, and of course, really with a minus sign under exchange. And we're done with the ground state. So for the excited state, we leave one electron in the ground state, and then we can put the other electron in an n equals 2 state, and there are two choices. We can put the other electron in the 2s state, or we can put the other electron in the 2p state. And it's an incredible problem to do this integral, because that quantity depends on the vector difference between those two particles. But the details are sitting there on the web. And the upshot was that the triplet state, the state that has symmetric spin and therefore has anisymmetric space, in fact has lower energies than the ones that are singlet states. And the P states are always higher than the S states. Okay, and I think I said I didn't give you a nice printout of that sort of situation, so let me at least do that now. Let's take a look at what the facts are as opposed to what the calculation is, because as a matter of fact, this particular calculation isn't great. I hope it goes without saying that you can get large numbers of significant digits if you do it right, but the righter you do it, the less likely that you're ever going to see it on the blackboard. Okay, so you might pull out your spectroscopic sheet. So I take it you're all very used to the hydrogen atom, right? Where we have energies that are 1 over n squared, we have transitions between them. So we go n equals 1, n equals 2 to n equals 1 produces an ultraviolet photon that's called Lyman alpha. N equals 3 to n equals 2 produces a red photon that we call Balmer alpha. But things are more complicated when we've got multiple electrons. So this is the energy level diagram for helium. And we have singlet states where the spin of the two electrons are in opposite directions, and we have triplet states over there. And lo and behold, notice that so here's the ground state, right? We don't care a whole lot about that. Here's the triplet state, and lo and behold, it has lower energy than anybody else. If we look numerically at what the splitting is between those two states, it turns out our calculation isn't great, maybe a factor of 2 too big. It gets the order right, but it doesn't get lots of significant digits on it. And you might also notice that according to this calculation, singlet S lies above triplet P, whereas in fact, singlet S lies below triplet P. I don't know, this is the same thing, except it's it's harder to read, but it's the same story. They haven't bothered to show the ground state because it's so far away. So here's the triplet F state, here's the triplet P state, and the triplet P is actually above the singlet S. And I don't know, the numbers are all there. So we got some things right, we got some things wrong. We can do arbitrarily better, and in fact, I don't know if I'll assign it or not. It's not too hard when we get to Rayleigh-Ritz to do kind of 2 or 3 significant digits of accuracy. Okay, so that was that. So we then go on to try and deal with the periodic table. And the starting point is, how do we deal with a multi-electron atom without really quickly becoming really complicated? And what Hartree said is we can think about the electron moving through the cloud of the other electrons. That is to say, instead of dealing with all of this interaction potential, let's just think of the net charge density of all the other electrons, some cloud around the nucleus, and solve that problem. That guy also requires a computer to solve, but since it's still single particle, it's pretty easy. And what you find, as we said, you can argue semi-classically, and if you want, you can look at the wave functions and come to the same conclusion. The high L states are circular orbits, and so they're by and large outside the inner electron cloud because the semi-major axis goes like the principal quantum number squared. The N equals 2 states are 4 times further out than the inner electron states, so they're pretty much outside. So the large L, maximum L circular states are going to have relatively high energy because they're not going to see the full nuclear charge. The small L states, those are the cometary sort of orbits that are really squashed ellipses. They're going to go right to the core of the nucleus and in fact have a probability of being inside the nucleus. And so they're going to feel the full nuclear charge, and they're going to have lower states. So we call this L state tilt. That is to say, we had degenerate SPD states in the hydrogen atom, and now the S state is going to be below the P state, going to be below the D state. And if you haven't already memorized this crazy set of letters that decomposes what the L value is, you need to do that. Okay, so the other thing we had is Hund's rule, which is a qualitative rule. It's not super true, is I guess what I'm trying to say. It's a rule of thumb that is often, but not always true. And what it says is that if we maximize the total spin of the electrons, if to the largest possible extent we have all the electrons spinning the same way, then we're going to have a symmetric spin state, which will allow us to have an anti-symmetric spatial state. In the anti-symmetric spatial state, the electrons are apart, and that means we're not going to have as much electron-electron repulsion, and things are going to give us lower energy. Okay, so far so good. Okay, so let's make the first cut at talking about the periodic table, the way the chemists think about it, which is of course wrong, but it's, you know, not all bad. So what we've got is, with the statement about L tilt, we've got a ground state, which is 1s. We've got excited states, which are 2s, and 2p is above that. We've got 3s, 3p, and 3d. And we just start putting in electrons as we fill up the periodic table. And, you know, so here's your periodic table. You got one electron, you got hydrogen, you put it in the 1s state. We're talking ground states now. You put two electrons for helium, you've got that. There's lithium, beryllium. Now there are really three states here. Right, according to the crazy chemists, they would be Px, Py, Pz, but we know better, they're really M equals 0, M equals 1, M equals minus 1. So we put the first electron in that state. So that's going to be boron. So maybe at this point it's smart to talk about the notation for something like boron. So in order to not bother to show this graphic display, we have some letters that tell us the same thing. So boron would be called 1s2 squared, because there are two 1s electrons, 2s squared, because there are two 2s electrons, and 2p. Okay, so on to carbon. According to Hund, we want to put the maximum value of spin, so I won't pair that guy. I'll put him like that, and that would be that. That would be oxygen. Then I can start going to... Did I miss somebody? Who did I miss? Carbon. I did carbon. Oh, I missed nitrogen. This was nitrogen. So then I've got oxygen, fluorine, and neon. And then we start again with a single 3s electron. So what the periodic table is about is that we go through a cycle and we're back to 3s. So that the chemical elements that have 1s electron, hydrogen through francium, all behave chemically kind of the same. The ones that have 2s electrons, 2 valence electrons, helium through radon, they all behave chemically the same. Helium and radon behave the same, radium? Well, so the chemists insist on putting helium over there with the inert gases. But that's not really right. It really is has exactly the same electron configuration as beryllium, so let's put it where it belongs. So when we start filling up these shells, we come to kind of the first, so currently we're through neon, right? So we're gonna go sodium, magnesium. And then we've got all of these guys, aluminum through argon. That's gonna fill up all of these guys. 6 electrons there. But we don't then fill up the D shell. It turns out the D shell has been pulled up, or the 3D has been pulled up above the 4S. So after argon, we start dealing with the 4S state. And we go with the calcium, and then we start filling in the these D guys. So then we go, how many D electrons are there? I think we're good with that. So you might remember that the degeneracy of these states is 2L plus 1. So there's one S state, there are 3 P states, and there are 5 D states, and we go spin up, spin down, we get 10. Okay, so you notice that at the bottom we're gonna start filling in the F states. How many F electrons are there gonna be? 3 times 2 plus 1 is 7, so there should be 14 spots down there for this insert. Okay, so I guess I would have hoped that you'd all seen all of that before in a chemistry class someplace. True, false, kind of true. Kyle's saying, nope, it's all new to me. Do you got it though? Makes sense. It's not too hard. Okay, but it's not too true either. So let's go back to carbon. So that was the kind of picture we had. So one of, I guess I'm not sure I would call this Hund's rule, but it turns out that if you have a full shell, these guys are full complete orbitals. They are spherically symmetric and you can basically forget about them. So what we really want to focus on are these 2p electrons. And what we want to do is we want to get, you know, the real wave function, not this kind of arrowish stuff. So how are we going to go about doing that? Well, we did all that Clebsch-Gordan stuff for good reason, right? So if I take 2p electrons, right? So that would be orbital spin one, orbital angular momentum 1, and I add it to orbital angular momentum 1, what are the possible values I can get? Yeah, everything from the sum to the difference, right? So if I add those up, and if you go back to your Clebsch-Gordan sheet, it'll tell you exactly what linear combination will make each one of those. Of course, it's obvious, I hope, that this one has to be symmetric, right? That one's made by putting everybody in the same direction. If you go back and look at your Clebsch-Gordan sheets, you will see that this one is anti-symmetric, and that one's symmetric under exchange. I don't know, that should make some kind of sense, that if we start with something that is symmetric, namely 2p's, we put them together, we're going to get things that have definite symmetry. In this case, definite means alternating plus and minus. Another example of that same rule is if I add spin up, if I add spin 1/2 to spin 1/2. Right? We've said lots of times now what you get are singlets and triplets. And you know that this guy is symmetric and that guy's anti-symmetric. Now I'm throwing those terms singlet and triplet at you, which are all you know, kind of crazy old-fashioned words. And I take it you know that what we're talking about with those words are the corresponding degeneracy. That is to say, S states have only one electron, so it's not degenerate. And so one is singlet. If we've got three of them, then we're P state, we're going to have a triplet. Right? So spin 1/2, for example, can be called the doublet because there are two states, spin up and spin down. So that decoding, if it's not familiar to you, is that where it is? Yeah, I think so. On that sheet. And it's pretty obvious decoding. Okay, so what we want to do is we need to make a state that's overall antisymmetric. We can't do anything with the R piece of it because the R piece of it, the radial part of it, that's all determined by the fact that this is 2p. Right? So both of those electrons are in the same spatial orbit, so it has to be symmetric in terms of that piece. So the only things I've got left are the angular part and the spin part. And for that, it's mix and match, right? In order to make something that is overall antisymmetric, I can do that. So I can put it in a total angular momentum 2, so that would be called the D state. Notice, incidentally, I've switched to capital letters. So total angular momentum, we usually denote with a capital D. Single electron angular momentum, we use for a lowercase d. So this is singlet. Or I could do this. Right? So that would be triplet p. Or I could do this. Right? So that would be singlet s. Those are the only combinations overall that give me an overall antisymmetric state. Now, let me just comment. If I was looking at an excited state of carbon, let me get rid of all of these other electrons. So that's a potentially an excited state of carbon. Those two p electrons are separate, right? They don't have the same spatial state. So I could make either symmetric or antisymmetric combinations of 3p and 2p, and that would open up all of these possibilities then. Is that clear? I've got then a third way of getting a minus sign, and I can have this be either plus or minus after I'm done, and I can use the spatial state, the wave function part of it that you talked about before, to make that either symmetric or antisymmetric. Okay, so I think you can guess this pretty quickly becomes pretty complicated, right? So how about we deal with oxygen? We got 3p electrons. So now I've got a whole lot of angular momentum to add up and a whole lot of spin angular momentum to add up. What are all of the possibilities? Now, before we go there, let's write some more Hund's rules. So what we have here are three, well, it's going to be pretty dull, I guess. So we've got 3p, and we've got 3d, oops, and we've got singlet d, and we've got singlet s, right? Those are the states that we got out of this. And we don't have to go very far with Hund's rules to say that this is going to be the ground state, triplet p, right? Because it's the only one that has spin 3. If we go beyond that, the next Hund's rule says that the one with the maximum value of total orbital angular momentum has lower energy. So I claim that the energy levels of carbon, there should be a ground state that's triplet P, and then we should have a singlet D, and then we should have a singlet S. Well, let's see if it's true. So there's your energy level diagram of carbon. And the low energy states, the ones that have, where we haven't excited the electron out of the 2p state, has exactly the order that we've derived. So again, let me stress what we're talking about. When in modern, the idea was that different energy levels corresponded to electrons in different orbitals. All three of these states have the electrons in exactly the same orbitals, right? These guys. So this is different energy, not by being in different spatial states, but by how you arrange your angular momentum and spin. Okay, so it's all 2p, but we get different energy because of how we've arrayed the spin and orbital angular momentum. Okay, but we added all of the orbit to get a capital letter, we added all the spin to get a capital letter, but we're not done yet, right? Because now we can add the total spin to the total orbit to get a total angular momentum, which is usually denoted by J. So if I add my total angular momentum to my total spin angular momentum, what are the possible values? Well, for these guys here, it's trivial, right? Because the spin is zero. So the total J either has to be 2 or 0. And we usually put it as a subscript like that. Here, there's options, right? Because this is going to be 1 plus 1. So we're going to get everything from 0 to 2. Okay, so this bottom state, it's not really one state. There are really three states there, depending upon the relative orientation of the spin and the orbit of angular momentum. So again, going back to the solar system analogy, what we have for the Earth is the spin and the orbital angular momentum in the same direction. But we can think about the planets having their spin and their orbital angular momentum in any possible direction. Okay, it turns out for the solar system, lots of planets spin the same way. So in some sense, the total spin angular momentum is pretty big. And all of them are going around in the same way, so the orbital angular momentum is pretty big. So as a matter of fact, in the solar system, the total angular momentum is pretty big. But you can see it doesn't have to be that way. The planets could spin backwards, some of them could orbit backwards. There's lots of possible different arrangements for the orbital and spin angular momentum. And by vector adding, by Clebsch-Gordoning together, that L and that S, we can get those possibilities. Okay, so if you look here for the last version of Hund's rules, it's not exactly correct. So what it says is that the lowest energy state is the one that has the smallest possible total angular momentum. And that is true for carbon. So the actual ground state is triplet P0. But it turns out that if we have atoms that are more than half full, so think about oxygen, for example, instead of dealing with 5 electrons, this is going to maybe sound crazy, it's easier to deal with 2 holes. So go through and deal with the 2 holes, and it looks just like carbon, but then the rule gets reversed. If we're more than half full, then the lowest energy state is actually the one that has the biggest value of J. Okay, so where in the book do they have all of this good stuff? Well, they've got a nice table that gives us the ground state, spin, and total angular momentum, the whole shebang. Can't be there. It's got to be right here on page 217. So if you take a look at the case for carbon that we just did, triplet P0. If you take a look at the case of oxygen, triplet P2. So we're looking at carbon, triplet P sub 0, oxygen, triplet P sub 2. Well, I did the easy case, right? With, I only had to add together two things, and adding together two things is easy, but if I have to add together three things, I mean, what I have to do is add together first those two and then add the other one to those two, and then the order that you do it in plays a big role. It's a mess, but it's a mess that's been done, so we don't have to do it. So if you look here, which one of these says equivalent electrons? If you look here, it tells us what all of the possibilities are for the various electrons. So if we look at P cubed, I'm going to hold this up for a second. So if you look under this chart for P cubed, so that's nitrogen, right? It says that the possible states are doublet P, it's hard to read, isn't it? I think that's doublet D, and 4s. Do you see that for nitrogen? Not for nitrogen, but for any combination of three equivalent P's. And what equivalent means is they're in the same orbital, not what we were talking about earlier, where I put them in different orbital. Then all bets are off, and that's the table that's above it. Okay, so according to the rules, the ground state should be the one that has the biggest possible value of S, which is this 4. And it's actually easy to figure out what the total angular momentum is, right? Because if I add, so 4, what does 4 correspond to in terms of what I would call the angular momentum? So my question is, if I go on this chart, what number over here corresponds to 4? You don't see the 4? One and a half, right? 3/2. Right? Because what the multiplicity is, it's 2L plus 1. So if I put in 3/2, 3 plus 1 is 4. Okay, so the ground state supposedly is, where was I writing this? 4s, and then we've said that 3/2 is what the total is, right? Because I'm adding 3/2 to 0. And I don't know, check it out, right? Hopefully I got it right. We were dealing with nitrogen and quartic S 3/2. Is the answer. Okay, and the low-lying states then of nitrogen would be rearrangements of those angular momenta, not cases where we would have the electron actually excited to a different orbital, but just a different arrangement of the spin and orbital angular momenta. Not all of them are possible because the electrons are fermions, but the ones that are possible, people have worked out, and it's on the list. Okay, so you can see why the chemists like the simple version of this. But the ground state really is much more complicated than this 1s, 2s sort of stuff. You have to add together these angular momenta to get the actual ground state. And then the low-lying states will not be those that come from the electron actually going to a different level. It'll come from rearrangements of the spin and angular momentum. Okay, but the unfortunate truth is that this isn't really what we're interested in. We're not really interested in the energy levels. We're interested in the color of light that we get from the atom. We're interested in transitions. So for hydrogen, you know, back in modern, it was pretty easy, right? Every possible combination, there was a corresponding photon that made those jumps. But if you look at these other diagrams, not everything is connected with arrows. Not all jumps are possible. Maybe I shouldn't use the word possible. Commonly occur. So people get tired of saying commonly occur, so they use the word allowed. So we have allowed transitions and we have disallowed transitions. But you shouldn't read that as saying disallowed transitions don't occur, right? It's like everything your mother said, some of that stuff probably happened. Just because it was outlawed by your mother didn't keep it from happening. So how do we figure out what jumps actually occur? So if we're looking for a laser, what energy level jumps are going to be possible? And actually, one of the things you want for lasers are states that last a long time, that don't decay. And if there are no lines that go from the bottom of it, then it's going to last a long time, right? The only way it can decay is by either collision or by a rare possibility. And if we go back to helium, right, remember your helium neon lasers. I guess you can't see it unless I turn on the machine. I don't know why you can. I can see it perfectly well. Actually, you have to actually hit the on button to make that work. I don't know why that's that way. So soon you'll be able to see the energy jumps that were allowed with helium. And here's this state that we said was the lowest of the excited states. That was the triplet S state. There's no line leading from that. This guy is, it doesn't last forever, but it lasts way longer than the other states. Typical transition times, typical lifetimes for excited states of atoms are on the order of a billionth of a second. So you put an electron here, and it's going to fall down pretty quick. You put an electron there, and it's going to stay there for a while. And of course, if you randomly excite electrons, anything that came out over, you notice there's nothing that connects these two halves. Anything that ended up over there is going to end up here. Anything that ended up here, a few nanoseconds later, it's going to be in the ground state. So this guy sits around for a while. Plays an important role for helium neon lasers. Okay, so what are the rules that tell us what things are connected by lines and what things aren't connected by lines? What are the allowed transitions? What are the disallowed transitions? Well, one of them was obvious from that chart. You don't change S. The only things that were connected with lines were things that had the same value of the total spin. How about the other rules? Well, the other rules are listed here. So, first of all, somewhere, the very first rule, it's actually here at the bottom, there has to be a change in the parity. And what that means is that all of the states we've been talking about recently, the transitions don't occur. Because these guys had the same value of lowercase l. They were all in the same orbital. There was no change in orbital. And what this says down here is there has to be a change in orbital in order for there to be a transition. So the other rules are listed here. The change in the total orbital angular momentum has to be either 0 plus or minus 1. And the total change in the total angular momentum has to be 0 plus or minus 1, except the particular case of 0 going to 0 is disallowed. Okay, well, let's take a look at the chart that's just this guy over here. So, question one, what is this? Is that the oxygen iodine 2 molecule? Titled Atomic Physics, so molecules are unlikely. Todd should be teaching today, shouldn't he? This is all atomic physics.
Is it like the second ionized state?
Boy, it would really make a lot of sense if this was this, right? It's not. So this notation all predates an understanding of anything that was going on inside the ions. And so what they said is that when they dealt with oxygen, they commonly saw that spectra, but occasionally they saw this spectra. No, it's not different isotopes. Isotopes really have no big chemical effects. So whether it's carbon 14 or carbon 12, it has, okay, very similar. Todd could detect the difference. I couldn't detect the difference. Todd does part per million work, I don't. Okay, so oxygen 1 is garden variety oxygen, the most common type in your tube. If you excite it, you get oxygen 2, which is singularly ionized oxygen. Okay, so then oxygen 3, that would be doubly ionized oxygen. What do you do with the cations? I don't know the answer to that question. Nothing good is the answer. Okay, so oxygen 2, so that's oxygen that's lost an electron. And actually, let's talk about oxygen 3. So oxygen 3 is one that has lost 2 electrons. So if we go down from oxygen 2, that should exactly have the same electron configuration as carbon. And what does carbon have? It has triplet P, ground state, singlet D, and singlet S. Well, that's exactly what this has got, right? Singlet S, singlet D, and triplet P. And we have this rule about the lowest energy state is supposed to be the one that has zero for the total angular momentum. That's true too. But there are lines that are connecting those, and we've just said that there are no lines connecting those because the lowercase l's, the electron orbital that isn't changing. All of those are 2p electrons. So are there lines or are there not lines? So I suspect that the caption tells you the historically interesting, to me at least, story of what's going on here. So these lines were detected in astrophysics. People aim their telescopes at things like the Ring Nebula, and they saw these particular lines, and they were flummoxed. Nothing like that is ever seen on Earth. And so they said, I've discovered a new element, nebulum. Unlike any element on Earth, it has exactly those wavelengths. So what's the difference between a planetary nebula and what Todd has downstairs? Todd can buy oxygen. He can ionize it twice. But he will not see those lines. Never seen on Earth. Probably approximate, but might not be true now. Certainly was true then. So the difference between up there and down here is there's almost nothing up there. It's really rarefied gas. So you remember I said that these states, the states that don't have lines coming through to them, they are very long-lived. But out there, there's nothing for them to do. They're not going to run into a wall. They have no way of losing that energy. They're going to stay in that triplet state of that we talked about before, you know, for centuries. It turns out that a common hydrogen line has a half-life of 1 billion years. But we see it, right? If you don't run anything for 1 billion years, eventually you're going to come down. So in the rarefied atmospheres of planetary nebula, we see these lines that are formally disallowed because there's time enough for them to form. And so I don't know, this is all, you know, for good reason. So the upshot of this is you shouldn't take disallowed too seriously. I'm pretty sure Todd deals with disallowed lines all the time, but I guess I've never asked him exactly that question. So the last thing to take a look at is this little thing that I put in on the side. So what we have here are carbon, silicon, germanium, tin, lead, all arrayed with their corresponding lowest energy states. And I don't know, you can see it kind of works for carbon, right? Pretty much just like we said. For silicon, things are a little bit more widely spaced. For germanium, I don't know, the spacing doesn't look the same. Close but no cigar, and then it gets really bad. So these rules, these Hund's rules, it turns out that they're mostly good in the top half of the periodic table. And that as we go beyond the top half of the periodic table, things become more complicated and we have to have a different set of rules. So of course the most important question is, what famous dead physicist gets named for these rules? So I'm kind of interested in the history. So I've read his biography, but I don't remember the exact story. So Russell, who is not a physicist, he was an astrophysicist, he gets named for this, and Saunders, who was a physicist. So these rules about how things couple together, those are called the Russell-Saunders rules. But it's awful easy to change that R to an L and call them LS coupling, right? Because that's what we did. So sometimes they're named for famous dead physicists like Russell and, famous dead astrophysicists and physicists like Russell and Saunders. Sometimes they're called LS coupling. How about the alternative? What dead physicist gets named for those? Well, the alternative is called JJ coupling with lowercase letters. And it turns out that what you do under these circumstances approximately is you add together each individual electron's L and S, and then you add up all of those J's. Okay, so what the LS coupling was is we added up all the orbital angular momentum, we added up all of the spin, and then finally we brought those two things together. So what JJ coupling does, has to reach the same conclusion, but it comes in kind of a different order. There, what you're going to do is for each individual electron, you're going to add up the orbital angular momentum and the spin, right? You get two possibilities, spin aligned with the orbit, spin not aligned with the orbit. And once you've got all of those individual total angular momentums, you're going to add those all up to get the total angular momentum. Okay, so I don't know if you think this is simple or not, but the LS coupling is simpler than the JJ coupling, and that's all we're going to talk about in this class. Questions? You can ask Todd, actually. Going, gone. Okay, so that's all of atomic physics in 1.5 days. The next section in the book is all of solid state physics in 1 day. So how do we deal with electrons moving through a lattice. So think about the electrons in diamond, where there are lots of nuclei there, and the electrons are bouncing around inside that crystal. How are we going to do the quantum mechanics of 6 times 10 to the 23rd electrons? Well, simplification better be the answer. So let's get rid of the nuclei. These are bold simplifications. So let's, instead of having those nuclei, let's just spread out that positive, sometimes it's called the Jellionium model. Let's spread out that charge kind of uniformly every place. So what we have then is something that is homogeneous. And since there are now no special places, the electrons are just going to be bouncing around inside that crystal. And let's also ignore electron-electron interactions, right? Because those were plenty hard enough. So we have independent electrons that are bouncing around inside this crystal. That's free particle. And you know how that works, right? So for free particles, we have plane waves. Right, we have the K vector. Yes, no, this is familiar or not? Some people say yes. Kyle, he's the test case. No. Good. Honesty. It's good that you said no, I think. But it's gonna make me feel bad for a while, I guess. Because I think it's true. I don't think you've done that. Or maybe you have. I don't know. But let's go back to the one-dimensional model. So here, right, you remember that the eigenstates were like this, right? And so here we had sine of n pi divided by a times x. And this thing here, that's what I'm going to mean by k. And it had to be a sine function because we wanted it to be zero at the boundaries. If I have a cube, I just have to do this for every dimension, right? So this might be nx and ny. I'm going to make every side the same, but if the sides were actually different, I'd have a different a there. Now, sines are hard to deal with. I mean, what is the product of sines? Exponentials are so much easier to deal with. So you know that a piece of this is this, right? So I take my k vector, and I make it out of nx pi divided by a, and ny pi divided by a, and nz pi divided by a. And then what I've got here is basically the dot product of that, and this is putting them all together. Okay, so there's some holes in that argument, but Kyle, are you moderately happy? I'm not sure you should be, but the the other thing we want to show is that this satisfies Schrodinger's equation, right? And that's easy, because it's easy to take derivatives of this guy. It's not that hard to take derivatives of that guy either. But this guy is really easy to take derivatives of. When I take a derivative with respect to x, what comes out is the coefficient of x, which is kx. And if I take two derivatives, I just get that twice. So if I take the Laplacian of e to the I k dot r, what I'm going to get is I k x squared plus I k y squared plus I k z squared, all of that times e to the I k dot r. And those are vectors, not just multiplying together. And of course, this is pretty obviously minus k vector squared, right? X squared plus y squared plus z squared. And the minus sign comes from the I squared. So if I take minus h bar squared over 2m, times that, I'm going to get minus minus plus, I'm going to get h bar squared k squared over 2m, all times the same function. So this is an eigenfunction of the free particle Hamiltonian, and it has eigenvalue that is h bar squared, and that should look a whole lot like p squared over 2m, right? Because this thing here is the momentum. Slightly more familiar and slightly out of time, I think. So pick it up from there.